My name is Irene Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast Neue Musik Leben. This is usually a German podcast, but once in a while and sometimes even more often I do English episodes. And I love doing English episodes. I have studied classical singing and music, but I love to sing contemporary experimental new music. And if you would like to know more about me, please look at my website www.irenekurka.de. I will put this into the show notes. And in this podcast, I talk about topics all around contemporary experimental music. I share with you behind the scenes, insider knowledge, and I really want to bring you the human beings out of the new music world much closer to you. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, Neue Musikzeitung, which is a very important German paper about, music, about all topics of music. I'm also always very thankful when you email me and contact me. I get lovely, lovely messages from all over the world. And that makes me very happy and also motivates me to continue with this podcast. Now I have a little series for you because, well, last year I was supposed to travel to Great Britain and I love traveling to Great Britain. I was invited to sing in Oxford and, well, we all know what happened. COVID-19 came and all these things were cancelled. So far I could not travel to Great Britain and work with my wonderful colleagues there. And now it's almost a year that we have this coronavirus in this world and with all the regulations and things that come along with it. And so I was thinking so much about being with my colleagues, working with them. And I was really also curious to know how they are doing. And this is how I came up to make this little series with four wonderful colleagues. And they are composers, James Weeks, James Saunders and Tim Parkinson. And I'm also very happy to have as a guest in my show Juliet Fraser, who also is a soprano singer. And she is a colleague I admire very much. And so I'm very happy that she also is in my show. Today, we have the interview with Tim Parkinson.
Hello, Tim. Hello, Tim Parkinson. I welcome you into my podcast, Neue Musik Leben.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me.
I'm really excited to be with you here today because we were supposed to meet about 1 year ago in March at a festival called Audiocraft in Oxford. And I was so excited to go there and to meet you and James Saunders. And, well, we all know what happened. COVID-19 came and everything has changed. But at least we are talking here now about interesting things. And at first, I would like to know, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
Well, I suppose that I've always been curious. And when I was a teenager, I just found myself listening to what ended up to be, more and more, different music. Like any teenager, I think about 11 or 12 or something, I started listening to pop music. And then just followed my nose and curiosity. And if I liked a certain, artist, I would then just find out more about them and then find out, then one thing would lead to another. And then I found myself listening to an awful lot of progressive rock. Mm-hmm. And this music was just, I just found it incredibly free sounding. I didn't really obviously know, understand it very well at that time, I suppose, apart from it was the freedom of it and that really, I think, you know, held my attention. So, and then when, you know, with, I mean, I was, so I've always learned, you know, I learned piano since I was about six. So I've had that going on, you know, I was learning piano and studying music at school and everything. And then when I discovered through school that, you know, classical composers obviously had been doing this stuff with prog rock, all the time, and I got it. You know, then there was a connection there between my own interests and what I suppose is, you know, what was sort of like educational requirements of the time. So that led me down that path, really. You know, and people like Bartok and Shostakovich obviously was a sort of the first way in. You know, just things like that. It's continued from there, really, that I'm just always curious about music I haven't heard yet. So it's kind of gone on from there, and it kind of opens up a new part of my brain that I didn't know was there before. You know, when I hear something that's, you know, something new. So it's kind of, I'm still on the same path, really.
I can totally relate to that. I also always like listening to, well, new things or things I haven't heard or haven't experienced yet. When did you start composing then?
Well, I mean, so playing piano, I guess, I was always doing things like that as a child, you know, in the same way that, you know, children always are drawing all the time. So I don't know whether you would say, even like to an artist, when did you start drawing? You know, it's like you're always doing it in a way. But then, you know, there comes a point when the realization that if I wrote it down before the event, you know, before just making it up on the piano, you know, if I plan something, then that was kind of exciting, this notion of writing things down, planning them, you know, articulating things in time, you know, that I didn't have to remember. And also just this idea of getting other, you know, like being able to transport that onto someone else, you know, asking other people to play. I mean, the other attractive thing about kind of the discovery of classical music for me after, you know, prog rock was that pop music, I mean, it's all studio recorded, and in a way it's kind of, it has a glossy sort of kind of, it's kind of removed in a way, whereas listening to acoustic music, it's more real in a way. It's more a kind of piece of reality. So that was tremendously exciting, that if you just write these things down on paper, you can create sound in time. So, you know, I guess about 14, 15, I started to just to discover that, hey, you know, notation is usable.
You know? And as you said, it helps the performer or the other interpreters who do your music to, you know, get somehow into it, or yeah. What represents good new and experimental music for you, or what music do you like to listen to?
Well, that's a really difficult question, because what is defined by good? Just like, if I have to talk about my own music, I don't have the objectivity to be able to step outside and be able to kind of, you know, find the categories, really. So, I mean, really, it just has to hold my attention, draw me in some kind of way. If I don't know what's happening, that can be really interesting, but sometimes not as well, I suppose. But it's very, very difficult to, I find it really difficult to generalize. But I think generally speaking, I like music and art and anything really which is authentic and honest, in a way. I think that I think it can, I mean, there's, if bad art is just somebody lying, I think, in a way, possibly. I don't know. It's very difficult to make these generalizations, I think. But
you have a big overview, since you're curious and you're also curating a lot. And so how do you do that? Or what talent do you need for that to have a good program?
Well, I mean, with the concert series that I do is it's always been, I mean, we started it with me, John Leely and Marcus Trunk, Music We'd Like to Hear. We called it simply because that's what it was. We just decided to put music that we'd like to hear that no one else was playing at the time. And in a way, it still is that. Because lots of music exists really in our memory and in concept before we actually bring it alive and get to hear it. So it was an opportunity to do that. Lots of things that we'd either read about or things that had been spoken about that we had not actually acoustically experienced, that was the way in for that. And I think that's the kind of that's the core of the driving force behind that concert series. I think that's what's still there.
That's very personal also.
I think so, but it's also, I mean, with this spirit of sharing, really. I mean, it's really this feeling of, this is fascinating to me. I love it. I really want to hear what it's like. What do you think? Let's, I want everyone to hear it, you know. And what I really love about it is that no matter what you program, I mean, for me, for example, pretty much everything in the program is on an equal status. I love it all, but the audience reactions are fantastic because it's, if there was some way of having it as visualizing it as a graph, some people love one piece and hate another one. Another audience member will have the completely opposite experience as well. So there's this fantastic landscape of experience that all the individual audience members have based on what I have set out to be an equal number of pieces that hold an equal fascination for me, you know. So that kind of keeps it going as well.
For me, it's also very fascinating, and I like that a lot with festivals I've sang at Great Britain or Scotland, that you're, in my way, or compared to Germany, you can put very different pieces together or styles, and in a way you're much more brave, because as you said, it's about music and not just one aesthetic, and in Germany it's sometimes different. And so I always enjoy that so much, that whatever I've done, Wandelweiser pieces, and after that there was some, I don't know, crazy music from Hungary or something, which was really whatever, loud and wild, it's, I find that very cool, because it's, for me, it's then more about music, and I also enjoy that the audience seems to be so open that they also listen to everything and they say, oh, this is not my aesthetic, this is not my style or something, they're just there, and that's really cool.
Well, I like to kind of, I always think of it as I like to open up a space, really. So if there's a predominance of one quality of music, I want to kind of put something else often in to contrast, or just to, or in relief, so that one can show up the other a little bit more or something. And that can also work, you know, not just with two pieces or whatever, but with three or four, that you just sort of open up this kind of programmatic space, if you like, and with which the audience can then kind of move within their experience, if that makes sense.
Certainly, certainly. And what are the qualities you most appreciate in the performers you work with?
Honesty. I've written a list here because obviously you sent me these questions.
Okay. What's on your list?
Honesty, well, thoroughness, understanding, of course, mutual understanding, shared values, although that's a really that's a big generalization, but also just putting the music first, and for me as a composer, I am as much an audience to my own music, I feel, as a performer. So I kind of am working with them to make this, to bring about the realization of this thing, which is outside of me as well as outside of the performer. So this kind of shared, if you like, perspective, we're both looking together at the artwork itself. It's, you know, and then nothing else gets in the way of that. It's just how to make the music come alive, you know, in the best way, you know, that it should. It's always a collaborative process. So when the collaboration is shared, you know, sort of equally in some kind of, or has some sort of balance, you know, obviously, that's really important. If it's too much about the performer or too much about me, of course, it's, I guess it's not so satisfactory.
That's an important point you make, yes. I know that you also have been composing for the human voice, and since I'm a singer, I'm always curious about that. And how is this for you, or is it special or challenging for you to write for the human voice? I mean, there are also composers who don't want to write for human voice, so you do.
Well, I do find it challenging, because as an abstraction, I think, just to talk about the human voice, because I want to know, well, whose voice is it? What is the voice? I mean, you know, there's more uniformity between pianos, you know, or instruments. So it's not such a contrast or whatever. But with people, I think I kind of feel I'd like to know what kind of voice it is, but also what the voice is going to be doing. I mean, singing or speaking or something else, or vocalizing or whatever. I'd like to kind of. So I find it very difficult to think of the human voice just as an abstraction like that. I think if when I'm working with the idea of the human voice, it's usually with somebody in mind. Not always, but of course. But I mean, with the opera that I did, you know, of course, a lot of the human voice in there is either speaking or it's a kind of a singing style, which is just, you know, comes from the person itself, you know. So that's kind of what I had in mind as well, you know. Mm-hmm. But also, if I am writing for the human voice, the big problem is words, really. What words am I setting? And that's I'd say is a massive challenge each time.
I understand. Yes, yeah. I know what you mean, because every singer is so unique, and you know, some things are easy for me or for a colleague, and you have the timbre of the voice, and I also understand the other point that, I mean, the voice is part of me, of my body, and so it's always somehow together, and that's can be an advantage, but also a disadvantage, or can be also challenging at times for the singer. Yeah. And so how do your friends, family, colleagues, and audiences react to your sort of music, and how do you deal with their reactions?
Well, I think that they are, I can't really talk for them, really. I have friends, and we're still friends, you know, even after they hear my music. So, and I feel that when, you know, the music that I write really is, is just an extension, or it's a part of who I am anyway. So I don't really see a lot of difference between the music that I write and the person that I am when I'm with my friends. So hopefully that there's a quality there that they recognize. But also it's a very intimate thing or an exposing experience, you know, a lot of time to have friends listen to a piece of music that I've written, which, you know, in the earlier, you know, when I was younger, it's quite a excruciating, or not really, well, you know, it's a very exposing kind of experience, but I mean, I'm much more used to it now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we are in a very, I say, vulnerable business. I mean, we show yourself, or you show your ideas, or whatever your inner side, and I mean, there can be people who don't like it, and I know we have to. It's good to be confident in ourselves and believe in ourselves and be independent from what other people think. But I think it can be very challenging, it's more pleasant when people also like what I do, even though on the other hand, it can also make me grow if I realize, oh, maybe this critique is a good point. I mean, you have to probably differentiate if, you know, somebody's just saying something stupid or whatever, or is rude, or if there's some quality in it where I like, oh, I should go on with that, and then I grow and something else happens. And but I also feel it's very, very vulnerable what we do.
Well, there are many sides to the to what we do as well. I mean, all the work that we produce. So I think that, I mean, a lot of if an audience doesn't like what I do, then I just think, well, it's just not for you then, or, you know, which is fine. or possibly, you know, you're listening to a particular piece which I was, you know, I'm not always, I mean, not every piece doesn't contain every single, you know, a cross section of me as I am. So, I mean, you know, like playing through Beethoven, sometimes he's in an absolutely ridiculous mood. And these things, you just think, well, he was having a good day when he wrote this. And, you know, and then if you were to think that was everything that he wrote, then you'd be mistaken, you know. So it's quite difficult to generalize.
And do you think there is still prejudice against new and experimental music, and if so, what would you like to see change about it, or what are you doing to bring a change in these attitudes?
I think that I mean, prejudice implies knowing about something. So I think that's the biggest problem at the moment, is a general, you know, lack of awareness of just what I would describe as alternative music. I mean, in the kind of whatever the mainstream culture at the moment. I mean, particularly in Britain at the moment. I mean, I'm not sure about other countries at all, but the I mean, there's very little music on TV, for example. I mean, even like pop music shows have kind of disappeared. Classical music is almost completely vanished. Even the use of classical music in advertising or something like that is quite a rarity. If there's a fragment of a Mahler symphony, it's usually in like some high quality perfume advert or something like that. But so these kind of things are slowly kind of disappearing away, I find, or even the music that's used in TV, in documentaries or something like that, seems to be a very generic, similar kind of sound that is just on pretty much everything. So I'm kind of concerned about the narrowness of of what's kind of on offer in the center of the of public attention. That being said, and there's a huge amount, obviously, that's very, very much available now, you know, with YouTube and everything. So it's all there, but it's kind of, you know, I wouldn't say hidden from sight, but it's just, it's kind of off on the edges somewhere, and you, it's still up to you to go and look for it if you want to. So a lot of people, you know, just don't really have, I find, much of an awareness of that there is, that there are alternative ways of making music, or different ways of listening to music. And I've taught, you know, I teach. So a lot of the time I will just, you know, play something, I don't know, even Schoenberg or something. You know, I was going to say contemporary music, but let's talk about 100-year-old music. even with that, I'll play it to, you know, some of the kids that I teach and just see what they think. I love getting reaction from them and seeing what they think. And oftentimes it's not always negative. It's just what the heck, what's that? You know, what is that? And like I was saying before, it's a part of the brain maybe that they just haven't used before. Maybe, you know, like, what is that emotion? I'm not really sure what that is. Yeah, you know. And also this idea that, of course, there are different ways of listening. So and some people are still kind of looking for the story or an emotional narrative, or, you know, are you expressing your feelings, things like that. But these are kind of, you know, cultural stereotypes and so forth, that are, and tropes that are just keep getting keep getting presented year after year in public perception of how an artist or a composer should be and what the music is all about and so on, you know. It's sometimes, I mean, when you listen to some music, sometimes it's okay to be bored and just sit and relax and go off and go have your own thoughts, you know, that's okay.
Yeah, certainly.
You know, it's an acceptable response to music if you want it to be. I mean, I always say, you know, I don't have any special superpowers. I've just, you know, to appreciate this, I'm listening to it on the same terms as anybody else. You know, I'm just, obviously, I've got a huge amount of experience. I've listened to a lot of music, simply by being curious and exploring.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, obviously there are things that I don't like as well. So I'm not completely open to anything whatsoever.
Yeah. And sometimes it's also the daily state. I also had made that experience that I was in a concert and one piece, like, I really didn't like it. And then I got the opportunity to hear it, I don't know, a year later again. And suddenly I was like, oh, interesting.
that's so true. I remember I played a recital in the city of London, in the financial area, just a lunchtime concert. So and just anyone who wants to have their lunch from their, you know, financial jobs would come in and sit and listen to things. And I played just, you know, some contemporary music and experimental things. And I played a piece of Jörg Frey, and someone at the end came up and said, that was exactly how I'm feeling today. Thank you very much. You know, and I thought, well, there you go. It's that's really nice. It's a wonderful reaction there.
That's great. Yeah. Well, actually, right now we mentioned it before, in Corona, COVID-19. What a, well, interesting period of time. And I'm curious, how is life for you these days, or in Great Britain, and what's going on?
Well, yeah. So what can I say? Politically, it's not great. I think that Brexit is a catastrophe for a lot of people and a lot of musicians. At the very least, all I can say, what, you know, a difficult job, much more difficult. Or it would seem to be the case. And obviously, yeah, with what's going on at the moment, obviously it's, I mean, if you'd asked me that a year ago, I would have a lot more positive things to say. I mean, it's more easier to talk about a year ago in terms of what's happening in Britain, because I feel that it's, I mean, artistically it feels quite healthy in the sense that there are lots of people making lots of interesting and great work, I think. And one example of that, I suppose, is that and there's a lot of, you know, independent venues, and there's pockets of funding and money that are available if you know where to look for them, which is not always easy to find. But during the lockdown last year, a venue that in London called Cafe Otto set up an online sort of recording label and started releasing stuff every week, two albums every week. And they're still going. I mean, and they're over 100 different things. And so, and not all of those, you know, obviously it's not all British people, but the kind of the diversity and the variety of that music that's being given a platform there, I think is just to name one, for example, I find that really encouraging.
That's amazing. Yes.
And they haven't repeated anything, you know. I mean, there's never been a second album from anyone this last year. It's all new names every week. So I think, so that's fascinating. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot to complain about at the moment. I mean, COVID has affected everybody as well, but yeah, British musicians are feeling it at the moment, I think.
And what projects are you doing? I mean, you have been working with the composer James Saunders since 2003, and I also know already, because I looked at your websites in preparation for this conversation today, that you also adjusted your work to the circumstances we have right now, and you also developed something new, which will go on, and hopefully you also will have your live concerts again. So maybe that's also interesting to talk about, your work with James Saunders.
I guess. Well, we started working together. Well, I think we met each other in about 98 or something like that, 99. And then we started working in this way together in 2003 with the idea of just putting on a concert with no instruments, just simply sitting at a table. And the image was like a couple of newsreaders. I mean, it still would be a fascinating thing if newsreaders, instead of reading the news, they did actually just communicate in a different way with some sounds. But that's how it started. And we live very far apart from each other. We very rarely see each other except to do performances together. So we would have met at Audiograph last year, and there were other performances lined up. But obviously all this happened. And then we just started to make realizations of pieces that we'd played before, which required no coordination, no rhythmic coordination. So we decided to make video realizations of that, where we didn't have to synchronize. Synchronizing was irrelevant. So it works perfectly for split screen video or things like that. And then I started to make new work just on that basis, to make these sort of mobile sculptural DIY songs using domestic instruments or whatever you happen to have, and just recorded obviously very cheaply and simply on a phone or an iPad or whatever anybody has. And to put these kind of things together, and the structure is different every time. So I made four of these songs, and we made one recording of each of them, and put them on YouTube. But now I've sent it to some other people, and I'm starting to get different realizations of these songs now, which is really a joy to see. Hear these different voices again, different combinations of the same thing. Yeah. So that's where that line of work has gone in the last, 10 months.
No, it sounds like a great project. I will put the links about it into the show notes. And it's great that you make something good out of this weird situation. And I also have done some, I always call it table pieces, 6 years ago. And I also do some of them again. And also now I realized that in a weird way, they fit so perfectly in this time. So I also want to continue with that and maybe even get some new works done. And So how is then your, I always call it time management in these days or back then and now? And is there anything you advise your students or what helps to, live life or be a good composer or a musician?
Well, I find that, I've spoken to a lot of people recently who have been doing the thing of getting up early and doing the creative work before anything else. Quite a few people, fellow composers I've spoken to, have been doing this, and it's absolutely true. And I find it very good as well. Certainly to do one's own work before email or anything else, before doing anybody else's work, I suppose, I find is the best. Virginia Woolf called it the cream of the day, the first thing in the morning. I like that very much. I think that's how I feel about it as well. So that's my preferred use of that time. But also I kind of believe in daily practice as well, but that doesn't necessarily mean composing tons of music every single day. Sometimes it can just be checking in on the work, because obviously we don't always have so much time. So I find just going, like if you were a painter, you'd go into the studio and at least look at it, and then you can walk out of the room again if you don't have any time. So that's, at the very least, some kind of checking in on it is what I try to do every day.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm also, I like getting things done in the morning or really do it for me and my art. And then I also do meditation and other things in my routine. And I also like the repetition. And then you somehow something slowly happens or you grow, or sometimes you're like at a plateau and suddenly it goes somewhere. And but I also know people are very different. And I think also in the morning you're in a very, because you just woke up and you're maybe in this kind of intermediate state where you're maybe not fully awake, let's say. And I think you can be very creative, or maybe also the association works well to connect things. And well, thank you very much.
I find it's very clear. I find it really, it's a kind of a clarity that I don't have so much at other times in the day, just to grab hold of a thought or an idea or something. And one thing that I'm telling myself a lot at the moment is to trust in process and remain present. This is because, as you say, every day is different. Some days are fantastic and I expect the next day to be as well, and it never is. Mm. It's always different, or it's not so, or it's more disappointing, or whatever, you know. So every day is different, but if, at least if the practice is somehow regular, I find then I trust in that. Find a way through.
What are you thankful for today?
Well, there's a lot to be complain about, but I am. What can I say? I'm thankful for just my friends and my health and my lovely wife that I live with, and I'm making projects with myself. So I'm thankful that I have that curiosity to continue and to look for things. I'm thankful for what paid work I have at the moment as well. I'm very thankful for that and the community involved with that as well. So with the place that I work and that I teach and the colleagues that I work with. So, and the, you know, the wider kind of community and new music community in general, I feel very close to them, even though we're all very separated. And, you know, and I'm blessed with very lovely neighbors as well, which is not always thing anybody can choose. So, you know, I am counting my blessings here.
Super. And who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you, and what inspires you?
That's a really impossible question as well. I find that very difficult. What has shaped me? What I think about often is just simply being alive in the world at this moment. That's it, really, I think. Because
it's a big task.
Yeah, but I can honestly say that probably is the biggest thing that has shaped me. Super. I mean, you know, I've read a tremendous amount. I've listened to a lot of music. You know, I love painting. I'm an art in general. So there's a huge amount that I've absorbed and it's become part of me. But it is ultimately all we're in now as well. With which, you know, none of us have ever, at any point, no one's ever lived through the time that they're living through before. So it's always new. And I've never been this age that I am before. Mm-hmm. So that's, I was kind of slightly probably verging on one of your other questions here about what inspires me and keeps me going. I'd say that's probably, that's touching on that subject as well, I think.
Okay, cool. And what does it mean for you to be true to yourself and or authentic in the music business, and how do you keep true to yourself?
I make my work for myself first and foremost. You know, I am the first audience, I always think. So what was I thinking about this? I think it just has to interest me, and first and foremost, and to be honest about it as well, and to be kind of just to be honest as well. So if something's not working, or if it's I'm trying for it to be something that it doesn't really want to be, or that I'm not really wholly committed to it or something. I mean, I just recently, for example, I was working on something and I really wanted to make it work and it really wasn't. And I just took the decision to just forget it, actually, just forget the project and move on to something else. And it was actually, it's very difficult to let go of something, but it's a wonderful thing to be able to just let it go and move on to something else. And then I had a much better time with the project I then moved on to. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm very much afraid of authenticity being challenged at the moment in terms of our choices being again narrowed, or also the curiosity and choice being slightly interfered with by what happens now all the time with YouTube or anything on the internet is, you know, they just present to you things that they think that you would like based on your previous choices. And so often if I'm curious and I go to YouTube for something, I find myself looking at something else that I had no intention of looking at because my curiosity has been corrupted by something, by an alternative that's thrown in my face. So I'm kind of worried about that, the future of authenticity in terms of how our curiosity and choice lead us to find these things which inform us about ourselves then. So I'm finding that I'm being told what to listen to or to look at or something.
Yeah.
Which is annoying. At the very least, it's annoying.
Yeah. And what does success mean for you?
Well, again, it depends what you mean by success. So, to make something, to do some good work that I'm happy with, that's a measure of success. Because it depends what the intention is. You know, I think success is judged on what the intention was in the first place. So if I wanted to make a piece and I did, then great, that's good. And if I'm happy with it, I mean, that's obviously very important. You know, to have an idea in the first place, to finish it, to hear it, to have, you know, and then to share it with other people. That all of those are kind of levels of personal feelings of success, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then we are at the last question. I would like to know, which tip would you like to give young artists?
Well, trust in process. Work hard. Do what you like. Know thyself. Really, I would say, be curious. Don't be afraid of mistakes. There's a lot of bits of advice here. I wouldn't say that one is any more important than the other. But when you're writing, if you're making a piece of art, do whatever you like, I would say.
Oh, great.
And that's a huge. I mean, it depends what you like, you know, and who you are, of course.
Certainly, yeah. Well, I thank you very much, dear Tim. It was a pleasure talking to you. And I still keep my fingers crossed that eventually we meet. And I wish you all the best to you and to Britain. And yeah, see you around.
And to you. Thank you very much.
I really hope that you could take lots of inspirations and motivations and ideas for you out of this interview. I'm looking forward to hear from you, get ideas, suggestions, feedback through Facebook or email. I thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I hope that you liked it, and I also hope that this episode has inspired you. It would make me really happy if you could tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.